Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to my good bad brain. I'm a normal person, so I'm insane. I've got depression and ADHD, but I'm doing better since I medicated me. I'm still not always sure whether I exist or what being a person even really is, but I figured out a long time ago that being alive is beautiful.
Is it working now? Are we working now?
Yeah,
now we're working.
Oh, great. Okay.
Sorry. I don't know what's going on. I think my I downloaded this. It doesn't matter. It's technical. I think it should be working now. I've rebooted the thing. Rogue Avocado. Hello. Hello. Good morning. Good morning, Michael. Oh, good morning, guys. All right. I think I should be back here now. We'll see. Anyway, that's all to say. It's her birthday. We did like a socially distant hi, hello, you know, the other, which was really nice. We like all wore masks and then sat far down the table and ate sushi. We like, you know, I don't know. We've been very good about quarantine. So we were like, oh, we've been doing like Zoom birthdays for people and stuff. But it's my brother. But, like, we're borderline not quarantined anyway. It's like my brother, you know, I've like made contact and stuff with them. And in the past, like when we were starting. But then, I don't know. It was very nice. It was went by and it's silly, you know, had just like,
really,
it was just,
man.
it felt like old times. You're like, damn, I miss seeing people. It was cool. It was just nice to go for a drive. I think like maybe we should be doing that more. People should be more like once in a while, just cause it's, it just felt good to get out of the house.
Yep.
You know,
sure.
The highway is also like, are amazing when there's no people on them.
We've gone for a couple of drives in the desert in the mountains. It's pretty nice. Yeah, you got to do that.
Well, all right. So I'm going to get into it today. Now, I guess now that I've futzed through the 10 minutes of my sound not working and whatever, I think we'll just get into some questions because we got some nice questions this week. Welcome everybody. Anybody who's here. If you feel like asking questions throughout, just put them in the chat and I'll periodically go over and look in the chat window. You're welcome to do that. That's the whole fun of this, is making it sort of interactive. But I'm just going to go in the order that they were received throughout the week. And thank you. These all came in through the My Good Bad Brain Gmail. So you can always email mygoodbadbrain@gmail.com and ask these questions. It's probably the best way to do it, actually, because it's like so concise and I'll just check it. But all right, this person asked, I know quarantine stuff might be getting a bit much. Sure, but everything kind of gets magnified at this time. So my question or topic that I would love to hear you guys talk about is being mentally ill. For me, it's anxiety and depression. I feel you there. And being in quarantine with a partner that is a normie. My mental illness is really taking a turn for the worse when isolated, and it is starting to take a toll on our relationship. Like, talk about not knowing how much more one can take. Any advice on how to handle that would be greatly appreciated. I don't want to wear him down, but I also want to be kind and accepting to myself. Yes. Okay. Let's talk about that. Because I will say this is a extremely relatable. This is the constant question of having a neurodiverse brain with somebody who's more neurotypical and being in a partnership with them. I will say up front, I think the hardest thing with this is basically exactly what she asked, which is like, how much do I just, I think the trap that I'm always worried about falling into, I'll just say it that way. I'll say it as a negative. The trap I'm always worried about falling into is validating, quote unquote, myself so much that I'm just not doing anything and just becoming really insufferable and damaging to the people around me as well as myself. And just being like, well, what do you want from me? I've got this problem.
Right.
So how do I make space for that? And also try to, you know.
Yeah. So it's a good question. And I'm certain that the, that person is not alone in this experience. I imagine that many, many people and couples are having to confront this dynamic right now. And it's really hard. You know, you're kind of separate from your typical support networks, maybe treatment providers also. So I think it's a really hard time. And that's, you know, the first thing to acknowledge. It's probably a really hard time for both partners, right? Both the person who's asking the question and their partner who's separated from their support networks also. So what I would say that there are a couple parts of this. Okay. So one, I would actually start to be a little more careful about the use of labels like mentally ill and neurotypical, et cetera, or normie. And the reason I would be careful about those is I would just ask yourself, what is the impact of using those labels? Is it making it easier for you guys to talk about these issues? Or is it doing something different? And I think often what we see is that labels are shorthand for very complex dynamics and behaviors because it's just tiring to always describe things that we talk about a lot in their full complexity, right? So we just use a label. But also the impact of the label can be to shut down conversation. And if you find yourself using those labels and then arriving at an impasse over and over again, I would think carefully about how much it's helping you to do that. Even internally, like, oh, my partner's normal and I'm ill. Mm. Well, that sets up a particular dynamic. And that dynamic may not be working for you guys. And so if that's the case, again, I would just be careful about addressing, be careful about using the labels. The reason we use labels like diagnoses is because they point to treatment options, right? It's important to know whether somebody's demonstrating symptoms of depression, demonstrating symptoms of anxiety, demonstrating symptoms of thought disorder, because those are going to point us to different treatment options. So that's the point of using those labels, all right? So I would just think about that, number one. And then number two, you know, the thing about having anxiety symptoms and depression symptoms and having them get exacerbated in a stressful time when you're more isolated, which makes a lot of sense, is that it can be hard to kind of stick to your values, maintain healthy boundaries, and to do things that are effective. And I think that's what you got to figure out because, you know, one of the core assumptions of a treatment that I like, DBT, is that you are not responsible for all of your problems. You're not, but you are probably going to be responsible for fixing them. Right.
Right.
So, you know, when there's a partner involved, it's a tricky dynamic because your partner, you know, you want to have expectations of your partner. You want them to be kind of involved in your health and wellness. At the same time, it's very important that you don't outsource your emotion regulation responsibilities to your partner because that's a quick way to burn them out. And it's a quick way for you to get frustrated, especially if you have like a really nice partner who's like really wants to help and be supportive. They'll probably take that role on for a little bit, but nobody's going to be able to regulate your emotions for you. And so they're going to get resentful and you're going to feel bad for asking. So what I would encourage you to do is to, in a moment when you're feeling a little better, is to think really carefully, what are my responsibilities? What am I asking of this other person? And for you guys to talk about those boundaries together when you're feeling like relatively well-regulated so that you know what the kind of boundaries and expectations are. And then I would figure out, once you kind of have delineated those things, and you guys have to be, you know, it's tough to do that. You got to be like radically honest with each other about what you want and what you're willing to do. There, you know, there might be some hurt feelings that come up. Just commit in advance to having a radically honest conversation, taking some time to process it, and then really trying to stick to the boundaries and responsibilities that you guys come up with together. So, you know, to your point, Jarrett, like, yeah, validate you. I think every conversation should start with validation, but you got to remember, validation is step one. It's not the last step.
Right.
Validation is what you do so that you're ready to act. So, you know, you can validate yourself. You really should do that. But then you have to take the responsibility for regulating your own emotions. And sometimes it's appropriate to ask for help from your partner, especially if it's something you guys are both involved in. But they need to be prepared also in advance for what that ask is going to look like and what the boundaries look like. Does that, I know that was a lot.
It makes sense. It's tricky. It's just living in something. I think that is that dynamic. I brought this up actually last night talking to Allie just about stuff and something that you said a few weeks back about the difference basically between your perception of psychology, quote unquote, and social work. And this idea that it's funny because it makes you think of very Eastery, that Christian thing about faith without works is dead, that kind of thing. But that idea that the image we get in our heads culturally of what mental wellness work is like laying on a couch and ruminating, and that if we just solve the puzzle of where this thing came from, then maybe we'll know. Oh, it was because your mother was thought your butt was too tight or something like that. And then you'll fix your problems. And this it's a very bougie sort of thing. This thing of oh, you don't have any real problems. How do we get you to a place that you can actually live the amazing life you have and stop creating Woody Allen neuroses? That's the idea.
And it's not this one weird trick,
Exactly. Yes. It's not this one weird trick. Yes. So the other thing about it is I think the problem with that sort of vision of things that's, given to us by a lot of funny movies and stuff like that, but as my analyst says this, is that if you actually do have mental illness, A, it's hard to validate it in the first place because you think this is not a working person's problem. This is a fake problem. This is just in my head. I'm just going to get over it. And you don't feel like you're even allowed to give yourself the truth of wow, this is a fucking real issue. This is a thing that's tough to deal with. So you start there, you already have this class stuff of this is a rich person's problem. This is the problem or something. So, and then on top of that, if you do try to get into doing that, especially as someone who may be most of us are in a life situation that materially does not support you, just, that whole thing they say eccentricity is the luxury of the rich or something like that, that if you're a mentally ill person and very, very rich, then you're just eccentric. But if you aren't, then you're basically non-functioning and crazy. So,
For sure. So
I think this idea of a type of project, a type of work on one's own mental wellness that is oriented towards a kind of rumination, one weird trick, we're just going to talk this out and figure out my dreams, versus something that is functional, that is this idea of social work, this idea of hey, the labels are only there so we can understand the problem and start approaching it, but the labels aren't who you are. They're not whatever the fuck, that you're just looking at people the same way you'd look at people who come in a more traditional medical sort of ER and be like, well, do you have a cold? Do you have a broken leg? You're a person that we're just trying to figure out what the issue is so we can help you feel well. And that, I don't know, in a interpersonal relationship, on that same note, is I guess the thing that always is hard to figure out is the line between these, I don't know how to describe them, diagnosable sort of situations, things that there's some research and literature behind and processes maybe of approaching, and then ideas of codependency, real behavioral things that we see, which can be from such a good-hearted place. So I was just gonna say, in my personal relationship, I think we've been quarantined together, we're close together, we're both very sensitive, we're both very interested in being good partners, but don't always know the best way to do it. And sometimes it creates this gift of the magi thing where you're if I'm overreacting or having a thing because of my ADHD or depression or something like that, and that's negatively affecting my partner, then I want to lock down on it and try to control all of it and not reach out at all. But then they can sense the tension in the air, and they are so sensitive and weird that they can't be okay until I'm okay. And then it just turns this feedback loop of who's not okay and who's causing it.
Right.
And right. so trying to figure out how to ride that line of, I think it's always ends up being accepting a kind of paradox of, like you said, like taking responsibility and doing everything that I can, but also allowing another person to help, but also knowing that it's okay if I want to help somebody else, but I have to be able to distinguish between them and me. And like I used to do this thing for sure that when my partner was having some anxiety or something like that, that was definitely a thing their brain was doing to them, the way that I experienced my own things, not necessarily based in like reality, you know, that I don't know. I'd almost like, I'd try to help in the ways that I think would help me, and then it wouldn't be helping. And then I would like get annoyed and be like, why aren't you allowing yourself to be helped? And then like basically make the situation worse, because now I was making it about me, you know? So yes. I think just being able to know that your heart's in the right place and then distinguish this, you know, basically untangle codependency and know like, this is where I end and where you start. We are separate people interested in helping each other, but it's not all about me or all about you. There's got to be this way to ride that line.
Right. And I think kind of, you know, to try to boil down a lot of what we've been talking about, I think the bottom line to remember is that acceptance, which is like validation, and change go together, like cooking and cleaning. Cooking's great. Mm. You know, what cooking like is validation. Cook in this analogy, cooking is great. It's awesome, you know, but if you just cook all the time and you never clean the fucking dishes, just, it's going to be a mess.
Yeah.
You got to do both. You have to accept and validate and also change. And you know, the thing is like, you want to recruit helpers, but the onus is on you because no one can change you. Right. I mean, really, that if we could figure out how to change people against their will, or figure out how to change people when they weren't really doing the change work themselves, I mean, Jesus, the world would be totally different.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, and you've probably already done a ton of change work, you know, that's the thing to remember also is like, if you're writing in and asking us, I'm sure you've done a ton of change work already on your own. The thing is, you got to keep doing it. That's the problem. You know, you got to keep doing it.
Really funny. That constant lesson of repetition, it can be rather frustrating,
And I think you have to just reorient your perspective to like, oh, when can I be done with like maintaining my health? Never. You'll never be done. You're doing it forever. And you got to just find a way to do it that's like tolerable and maybe even enjoyable and fun. And sometimes you don't do it as well. And sometimes you take a little break and, you know, that's fine. The time horizon for change extends infinitely into the future. So you can always keep on going, you know?
Yeah. I think that's a good, it reminds me of like physical fitness stuff, that for me, we've gone 28 days straight of quarantine calisthenics, which is crazy. It's amazing. But one thing I've been finding with that, and just as my thoughts, you know, sometimes it's like somebody has to ask you a question for you to jiu-jitsu is like that all the time. Like as you're coming up belts and you're starting to get better, sometimes you don't realize like how well you know a technique or you don't realize even what your technique is until someone asks you and you have to like describe what you do. That I've realized like my personal beliefs now around physical fitness and wellness, whatever, is very much related to the mental health thing, which is you cannot be results oriented. You just can't. Because your body's a sandcastle. Once you've done anything long enough, you'll get injuries, you'll get life setbacks that will always move your goalpost. Like you can't be results oriented in taking care of yourself. That the only way you won't, at least for me, I guess, because for me, the idea of infinity is too insane. Like if I don't have if I get obsessed with something like a conclusion and then realize there's no conclusion and I obsess over that, I will just overwhelm myself and stop, you know? Yeah, so I have to learn how to create processes that I enjoy, that like, you know, rhythms and experiential things that I'm like, I enjoy this process. So like with working out, for instance, switching my mentality from how many reps did I get or whatever, instead of what does my body feel like, you know, switching to what does my body feel like? What is it like getting into my muscles today? I'm much less inclined to focus on how many pushups I did in terms of a number as I am to think like, how did my body feel in the pushups? How you know, controlled was my repetition? How focused on my shoulders was I? Things that, you know, are very present. And I think in general, trying to create processes that we enjoy the process of, I know I've just repeated myself like over and over again, but it's because this thought is sort of formulating as I say it. That seems crucial, is to get patterns and rhythms and practices and habits that you enjoy.
Right. So I think the way that I would kind of frame that in this context, I totally agree, is that those processes in this case would be like values and boundaries. So you may just not be feeling good one day, you know, and it may not be in the cards for you to feel totally free of any symptoms that day. I would actually abandon that idea and focus on your values for how you want to act yourself and how you want to treat your partner, and sticking to the boundaries that you guys have agreed are like the healthy boundaries for you. And I bet you, if you stick to your values and boundaries and abandon the idea of like immediate relief, that if you keep going through and upholding those processes, I bet you when you reflect back on your experience of symptoms that you will find some relief. I bet that will happen.
On that note, and maybe getting a little bit granular, but I just like to try to do this, you know, because the most functional things are like what I want to do. Do you have any ideas about like specifically speaking to this thing of quarantine, right? Like I can't leave the house. I can't go to work. Like you said, your partner's support systems may be less. You really are with each other. Like, have you found anything or is there anything that exists in literature already for like good ideas of like if things get heated or if things start to get too like overwhelming, I'm really like bleeding onto my partner and vice versa, like actual strategies? Like, do we just like separate and go to separate corners for a few minutes, put headphones on, you know, like what are good ideas if we're stuck together?
So, I mean, there's like a whole kind of couples therapy literature that, you know, people can get into. But yeah, I think there is no quarantine literature yet. I certainly think there will be one after this. There will be a large and growing quarantine literature following this experience for people. But yeah, I mean, taking a break from each other, if you have the space to do that, totally appropriate to do. Agreeing that not every problem has to be solved on the first conversation.
Yeah, that's good.
Agreeing that at baseline, you love and care about each other. And that's the kind of bedrock of your interaction. And on top of that can be frustration, anger, disappointment, all that stuff can be kind of on the surface, but at the root is your love and caring for each other. And then making sure that you are validating each other, like really. And there's a lot you can read about how to validate. Like, I think DBT has some really good interpersonal, I mean, one of the core skill groups of DBT, dialectical behavior therapy, is interpersonal effectiveness. And there are like worksheets in the DBT workbook, which you can buy on Amazon. It's like $20. And there's a lot of stuff in there. You know, there are like templates for how to ask for things, for how to say no. There are templates for figuring out your interpersonal values.
I've had somebody else specifically recommend the DBT workbooks that are on Amazon. So I mean, like, so that sounds like pretty like a good resource. I should have probably gotten a long time ago. Oh wait, say that again.
You're breaking up a little bit there, but there's also a website called dbtselfhelp.com, and it's not as like nicely laid out as the book, but it has all the same skills, you know?
Cool.
So, and that's free.
That's actually really good to know about. Oh yeah. I see. This is great. I didn't realize. Okay, cool. That's awesome. All right. Yeah, that's good. I agree with that. I would also endorse, if you have a few extra bucks, noise canceling headphones. Amazing.
Yeah, for sure.
Amazing. Just trap you in your own little world. It's fantastic. all right. Well, that's helpful. Okay. Let's do I'm gonna do another question. We're gonna move on to this next question. Let me go to the right screen. I've been clicking around. Hi. Okay. This question relates to Dr. Nick Barr's discussion of fusion and diffusion in ACT. I'm just gonna read the question. I don't know. Fusion, diffusion, ACT. I'm wondering if he can discuss how dissociation might relate to this. I tend to be in either fusion or complete dissociation and feel like I can rarely hit that sweet spot of diffusion without completely intellectualizing away my lived experience. I have ADHD, BPD, and PTSD, and often go into prolonged dissociative states. So I'm going to just a few of these. Let's see. Obviously, ADHD is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. BPD is bipolar disorder. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Borderline personality disorder.
What did I say? Bipolar?
Bipolar disorder.
I'm sorry. I meant to say, are those different things, or is that, those are different things?
Yes.
Borderline personality disorder is totally different. Sorry. Thanks for correcting me. Glad we have a fucking doctor here. And then, what is ACT?
Well, okay. So I'm sorry to be annoying. It's actually ACT.
Oh.
ACT is something different. So they, and the developers of ACT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy, they like are very, strident about you calling it ACT, not ACT, because ACT is something else. So
okay.
ACT is, yeah, sorry.
No, don't be sorry. This is important. Like, I'm like, okay, good. Now we know.
It's not me. But ACT is acceptance and commitment therapy, which is like a third wave behavioral intervention. So the third wave interventions are things that incorporate mindfulness, like ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, which I reference a lot.
Right.
And DBT was initially developed and validated for work with people who have borderline personality disorder. Also, I'll just say that term, borderline personality disorder, it's not a very useful descriptive term. It's a Freudian term, and it dates from when people thought that that the spectrum of mental illness was psychosis and neurosis, and people who had something in the middle that was like neither psychosis nor neurosis, they called borderline.
Got it.
Because it was between psychosis and neurosis. But of course, we're far past that conceptualization now. So a way to think about this is a emotion regulation disorder. That's how Marsha Linehan, who is a psychologist who developed DBT, that's how she conceptualizes the disorder. And I think it's the most effective and evidence-based conceptualization. So it's an emotion regulation disorder.
That's okay. So interesting. I'm just slightly hijacking, but like, because I think this about ADHD stuff a lot as well, as I've come to understand it, how poorly named that is, how poorly named and described and understand that is. And I try to describe it to people now is, instead of thinking of it attention deficit, hyper, blah, 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 is it's better just to think of it as a focus regulation disorder that like, you can't regulate because you hyper focus sometimes as well as having scattered focus. And that like, it's just interesting to hear this other thing is like emotion regulation, focus regulate. Like it's just that.
Yeah. I mean, look, think about how things get named. It's like the first person's traction with their article, their name gets adopted, but that doesn't mean name or that it reflects like the best available evidence. It probably doesn't. You know, if it's been studied well over time, we should be learning more, and probably what we learned is going to discount some of the earlier assumptions. So, you know, but we're stuck with the name. So whatever. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's very good.
You know, is the point, but yeah. So this person is talking about cognitive diffusion and, you know, getting stuck in either fusion or dissociation. So, you know, and I think they mentioned that they have a PTSD diagnosis. So, and a BPD diagnosis.
Do you mind can you explain about that fusion diffusion thing a little bit?
Yeah. So cognitive fusion is a term that's used to describe the experience of having a thought and having that thought take over your attention so that you have a thought pop in your mind like, oh, this person doesn't like me. And then you laser focus on that thought and that thought expands and occupies your whole reality. And you utterly believe that thought and you're utterly invested in that thought to the expense of everything else. So that would describe the process of being fused to a thought, right? Like it's inescapable. That thought, suddenly you're in the balloon of that thought. Okay. And then defusion is the process of like separating the observing self from the thought that is occurring in your mind. So there's me, Nick, and then thoughts arising in my mind and emotions arising in my mind and falling away from my mind. They arise into my attention and they fall away out of my attention. Okay. That would be akin to cognitive defusion. Like, I'm having the thought that this person doesn't like me. It's just a thought that's arrived in my mind. It may be true, it may be not. There's me and there's this thought that I'm experiencing, and I want to respond to that. Do I care about it? Yeah. Do I want to collect some more evidence? Okay, maybe. Do I care about it? No. So do I want to collect evidence about it? No, because I don't care one way or the other. You know?
Yeah.
That would be more akin to the process of defusion. But then dissociation is when you have the experience that what's going on in the world is not real. That, you know, sometimes your body isn't real and your sensory experiences aren't real or your thoughts aren't real. It's as if you become untethered from your body or experiences.
I have experienced that like a lot.
Yeah. And actually, especially for people who have like childhood trauma that accounts for some of their PTSD symptoms, dissociation is a way for, it's actually a way for the body to, and the mind to cope with traumatic experiences, because especially when you're young or if you're trapped and you're not able to escape or fight, dissociation is protective, can be protective in an immediate trauma or crisis setting, right? It insulates the brain from processing all these horrible experiences.
Yeah.
Okay. So you know, it's a built-in function of the brain. The problem is it's not a useful strategy for like dealing with your everyday life, right? So in BPD, which is an emotion regulation disorder where the person has a natural predisposition to experiencing super intense emotions and they may not have learned effective coping strategies for regulating those emotions, like they were born with a Ferrari engine and nobody taught them how to drive it, you know, and when you have a Ferrari, you really have to be a good driver, right? So then it becomes easier to see how that person could dissociate more because they're just overwhelmed by intense emotion a lot and they don't have the effective tools and strategies to regulate those emotions. So the kind of the way to deal with this when you have PTSD and BPD, one or the other or both together, is you got to get treatment to learn effective emotion regulation strategies and physiological relaxation strategies. Okay, you got to learn how to calm the body down and then regulate emotion. Right?
Yeah.
And just thinking about it, like just thinking ain't going to do it. You have to physically relax the body with things like deep breathing or progressive muscle relaxation, intense physical exercise, activating the dive reflex, running your face or wrists under cold water. There's a list of these strategies in the DBT book. And this skills area is called distress tolerance. Short-term crisis survival strategies for when you're at super high emotion activation. And most of them are physiological to regulate the body. But then there is the emotion regulation side, which is the long kind of steady work of learning to regulate your emotion, to get your emotions back into the bandwidth where you can be effective, where you can act effectively. It doesn't mean you feel no distress. It just means they're back down in the bandwidth where you can act effectively and in accordance with your values. Okay. Right. And that takes like daily work. You have to be hitting these skills every day. It's like training, you know, it's literally training for your brain. The good news is if you do this training for, I mean, the most evidence supports DBT for about a year, but if you do this training consistently, you will learn these skills. You will start to apply them with less and less effort and you'll get lasting change. I mean, you will, but you got to work those skills every day. So just trying to think your way to the sweet spot of diffusion, it's not going to work, especially if you have BPD symptoms and PTSD symptoms. You've really got to learn physiological relaxation and emotion regulation, and you have to practice those skills every day. And then once you've adopted those skills, you will notice that you're able to start getting to that sweet spot where defusion doesn't result in dissociation.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's interesting. It made me think of, I don't know, I think as an uneducated person, I tend to do the thing artists do with physics principles, which is like you just see something and you're like, wow, that's like applies to everything. But so forgive me for this metaphor, but it feels like, or analogy rather, that, you know, I did this, some of this mobility training, you know, just took a seminar or two and did some stuff. And I forget what it's called, but it's the one that does cars, you know, controlled articulated rotations and stuff. It's like very intense. It's very like, you're flexing the whole time. They call it radiating, and you're trying to just control your muscle. Anyway, the theory that they have with it is basically that, like, when you think you're inflexible, when you think, you know, that their theory is actually, it's not that you're not flexible, it's that you're just weak. Your muscles are weak in these end ranges of motion, that you have the ability to go there. Like, your body could be twisted into these positions, but it would hurt a lot, and you have no regulation over the muscles when they are, like, you'd have no neural pathways when you are in these extended, they call it end ranges of motion. And so that the practice, it's very intense. It's very uncomfortable. But I think if you've had any experience with strength training, you can pop into that mindset quicker, where you go like, okay, so I'm actually not just trying to stretch here and live in this pain. I'm trying to increase my strength and carve new neural pathways in my central nervous system that help me command in this region. Like, you'll do one of the exercises is literally like your feet are on the floor, like without socks. Well, you can have socks on, but when you, and you try to just lift your big toe, and then you try to leave the big toe down and just lift your other three toes. And it's so fucking hard. Like, you start doing these just little things. You're like, oh my God, I have no control over these individual things. But anyway, part of the thought is also like when you're doing some of the work with your external rotating and your hip flexors and zones that are very tight on people. And I apologize for getting so physiological, but whatever, that it can be very intense and you start cramping, you'll just cramp. And one of the things that they teach when they teach it is that, like, don't be so afraid of cramping. Everybody tries to immediately run away from cramping. They go like, and get it out and Charlie horsing. But they were like, I promise you, if you sit in some of these cramps, that you'll be okay. Like, it'll hurt, but you'll be okay, and it'll relax eventually. And there, again, their suggestion is the reason you cramp potentially is that your body's so unused to working in these end ranges of motion that your brain basically panics and sends so much signal to say like, turn on, because you're trying to, because you have no regulation down there, that it just cramps. It just turns on, like, you know, 100%. It's like turning the faucet on all the way. And it's only by sitting in those positions and practicing there that your body will learn how to regulate and say like, oh, okay, we don't need to turn on like all the way. We can just do a little bit and tell it what to do. And that's how you teach your nervous system to like be more flexible and strengthen those end ranges of motion.
I think that's a really good analogy. I mean, the thing I would say is that also, like, when you start to do this stuff, when you depart from your old style of regulating, you will experience discomfort because you haven't learned the new skills well enough to use them effectively. And you're trying to not use the old strategies because they have not served you. And so you're kind of stuck in this liminal zone where, like, you don't have anything that works that well in the moment. And that's normal. So, is, you know, in the framework that contains this stuff on the pathway to feeling better is a lot of discomfort. And so that's why it's useful to have a therapist that you're talking with, because they are like, yes, you know, this is an evidence-based set of skills. You're on the right track. It's normal to experience discomfort. You know, it's useful to have that person to kind of help steer you a little bit as you do the work. But, you know, you got to just know that skills acquisition and abandoning ineffective strategies, it's going to yield periods of discomfort, and that's evidence that you're on the right track.
I always reassure myself too, that if you've been tough enough to get through without any of these tools at this point, then you're tough enough to deal with the discomfort of getting better at it. You know, it just helps me like to think through that stuff. Are there any, that made me think, I have a question about this too, just related to the dissociation thing. Are there any extant strategies for creating sort of like reality anchors, you know, that like, if I do start dissociating so much that I can go like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, I have this, I wrote like a poem one time that I was like, based on a real experience where I was like, I just took an edible. I was too high like a long time ago when I was inexperienced with it. And I remember just like mantraing to myself that like, in the moment, but it became like something I still remember, was like, I'm real, you're real, we're here, and things matter. And I would just like repeat that to myself. I'm here, you're here, we're real, and things matter. You know,
I love that. Also, I just saw a poem that was like the first line of quarantine emails that people have been receiving.
Oh, I saw that too.
So funny. Yeah, that's great. So, I mean, yeah, the tried and true strategy for getting out of dissociation is narrating senses in this present moment. So what are you seeing? What are you tasting? What are you smelling? What are you touching?
Did you say narrating experiences? Sorry, it fritzed out right when you said.
Narrating the input coming in through your five senses in this moment. So what does it feel? What does your butt feel like in the chair? What is the grip of, what are the armrests of the chairs feel like in your hands? Are they soft? Are they hard? Is there wood grain? You know, what color is the rug in front of you? What sounds are coming into your ears? Like getting grounded in your five senses, because your five senses are pretty much always receiving direct input from the present moment. So that's the strategy. Damn. And we do that in, you know, like if someone starts to kind of go into dissociation, you're like, okay, come back to the sound of my voice. Tell me what your seat feels like in the chair. Tell me what your hands feel like on the armrest. Open your eyes. What are you seeing? You know,
that's really useful. That's like so immediate. And yeah, that's good. I didn't even know. I remember being led through some of those exercises that were like super helpful in therapy just for coming out of my head. And, yeah. You know, I've spoken on here before, but like a moment of epiphany I think about often was being in a therapy session and my therapist just offhand saying like, how you feeling? Or like, you know, yeah, just how you feeling? Like meaning, how's it going? Something like that, something like offhand. And I just realized I couldn't feel my body. Like I was like, I don't know what I'm feeling. I literally don't know what I'm feeling. And then we went through this exercise of like feeling the chair and stuff.
Yes.
But anyway, okay. And we'll do this last, we got like 10 more minutes. I think we'll just do this last question that we got this week that I wanted to just include. Okay. Cause it's kind of related to the last thing a little bit, PTSD stuff. Wondering if you dudes can talk about PTSD related short and long-term memory loss and some tools to help with that. Some days I'm super on top of things and others like yesterday are filled with me getting increasingly frustrated with myself. Also wondering if there's a crossover of PTSD memory loss and depression brain fog. And if you can explain what's going on in my brain when I'm experiencing them.
Yes. So I love this question. I just sent you a little link here with just a little resource, but I'll pull more. So let's start with PTSD. So PTSD is hypothesized to be a disorder of memory and fear processing. Okay. So there's a part of your brain called the head, which is like this little organ. And this is a growth.
Wait, hold on. Slow down. Wait, hold on a second. I'm going to ask you to restart that. Hippocampus, because something's happening with our connections getting fritzy, but go again. Okay. Go again.
Yeah. So this is an oversimplification, but you can think about this little part of the brain called the hippocampus as kind of the memory storage unit. Okay. And what happens in processing is that memories get tagged with a date and time stamp and they go into the hippocampus. And so then when you retrieve.
Oh man, what's happening? Hold on. Dr. Knight, did I lose you completely? No.
Then this is
wait, hold on. PTSD. Nick? Are you there? Hello?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Oh, you like totally disappeared for like 20 seconds or something. Are you there?
Okay. How about now?
Oh, this is so frustrating. We're like writing the good stuff right at the end here. Try it again.
I'm going to just text you not to use internet just in case.
Oh, it's okay. We're almost done here too, I think. Okay. So back up again. So, I'm sorry to back you up to hippocampus again.
Yeah, no worries. So hippocampus is like this little organ in the brain that you can think of it as storing memory. With me?
Yes.
Okay.
And then no. What is happening?
With like sorry, a date and a time stamp.
Ugh, gosh, golly. Do you want to try disconnecting and reconnecting from the call?
Yeah,
I'll do okay. That. Okay, do that one real quick. Hi, are you there?
Yeah, how's that?
Way better. Weird.
Okay.
Hippocampus. So,
So hippocampus is like a little memory storage unit in the brain. And in normal circumstances, it would get tagged. A memory would be tagged with like a date and a timestamp. And then you could retrieve it, to, you know, when you remember it. and it's located in that date and time, and your emotional experience is related to a past event, right? But in a trauma memory, there is a disruption in how it gets stored in the hippocampus and in the kind of network that processes memory, which is attached to the limbic system and involves emotion. And so your brain doesn't store that as a past memory. And every time it comes up, it feels like it's happening right now. It doesn't get tagged with that date and timestamp. It gets like misfiled, the trauma memory. So PTSD really is a dysregulation in the fear and memory processing network. Okay, so it absolutely does impact memory. The other thing is that if you are experiencing trauma symptoms often, trauma symptoms put your body into a hyper alert, hyper activated state. It's the activation of your sympathetic nervous system, which is preparing you to like fight or run. And when you're in that physical state, your brain's not, your prefrontal cortex, which is like your executive function and memory storage, that's not happening. Your body doesn't need to be doing that. Right? You don't need to be doing like higher order thinking, planning, reasoning, because your body's like, oh, I'm in danger. Right? I don't need to be like doing math. I need to be like getting ready to get the fuck out of here. Okay. And if you're getting triggered and in that state often, it disrupts your ability to process memory and encode memory. So that's like kind of the PTSD side of things. If you also have depression symptoms, and by the way, I've never seen anyone who has had, you know, ongoing PTSD symptoms who does not also have depression. And some people argue that, you know, chronic expressions of PTSD are really indistinguishable from comorbid PTSD and depression. Mm. But depression, we now believe, is actually associated with a hyperactivation of the brain. It's not like like a slowdown of the brain. It's the reason people feel just like exhausted mentally is because their brain is so overactive, ruminating and worrying and, you know, having other cognitive processes associated with depression, that there's just this exhaustion.
Anxiety has a similar thing, doesn't it? There's like an anxiety when people have anxiety, they're just so over, they get the same.
I've never seen someone with depression who doesn't also have anxiety.
That seems to be my experience as well. Like, cause I've never been diagnosed with anxiety, but it's like indistinguishable so often when I read or see things, you know?
Yeah. It's not, you know, some people who have anxiety don't report depression, but I've never treated anyone with depression who doesn't also have anxiety.
Interesting.
So when you have depression and PTSD, by the way, PTSD used to be classified as an anxiety disorder. Now it's its own thing, but there's overlap. So, you know, when you have those things happening together and your body is in this elevated reactive state, you're not encoding memory in a normal way. So you have to calm the animal, right? You have to calm the animal so that your brain and your body know I don't need to fight. I don't need to run. I'm in a safe place. This is now. And that will allow you to start encoding memory in a more like normative way. But again, you know, if you have one of these complex disorders, like if you have complex PTSD with comorbid depression, I really think you got to get treatment. I know that's very hard to do right now. Certainly there's kind of like self-help steps you can take, but there's no substitute for like a really skilled therapist helping you to manage the stuff. But the short answer is it makes sense that that's happening. You know, memory disruption is part of both of these problems. It has to do with kind of disrupted storage in the hippocampus. And the overactivation of the sympathetic nervous system and the body's fight or flight reflex, which interferes with executive functioning and kind of like managing complex information.
Yeah, that's really helpful. That makes sense. They do feel so related that you know, the brain fog thing I totally relate to. I mean, I've talked about this before, and just again, as a non-educated, not trained person, just someone who has some things and whatever my layman experience of it seems like part of the reason diagnosis is challenging, especially if you do it from a psychiatric point of view or whatever, is it feels very much like if you got a rash And then someone was like, well, what's the mechanism behind the rash? Could be a virus, could be a bacteria, could be an allergy, could be some weird fungus, could be like, you know, whatever. There's so many reasons you could have a rash. And it feels like when someone says like, oh, okay, well, I have rejection sensitivity dysphoria, I've read, is what they call a thing that comes with ADHD, is like this overprocess, you know, this they call it a emotional hyperarousal. But like, how do you distinguish from that and BPD, you know, or anxiety, depression? Exactly. Like you get this brain fog, you're like overthinking things, even things like I've read about things like with autism and people that say like they can't look people in the eyes and, you know, that there's this sort of lack of, you know, empathy or something like that. It's actually like hyper empathy. Like you feel, they feel so much, people who have that, you've got so much presence and experience of it that you have to just shut it down because it's too much experience. So it feels like a lot of crossover with a lot of these things that does seem to just have to do with your reaction. Like, what is your way to you process things? How do you regulate your responses to normal inputs?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it kind of loops back to one of the things we were talking about earlier, which is this idea of like, look, scientists love nomenclature. Okay. Like we fucking get off on that, man. Like making up funny name, like making up names for things that are like unique and people are like, oh, that's a good, like we fucking love that. Okay. Yeah, but I would just caution people, don't get too wrapped up in that. Don't get too, don't let your focus on the lit nomenclature or the jargon eclipse the point. And the point is to help you manage what you're going through in a responsible, effective way so that you can move towards your values and goals. That's the fucking point.
That thing about you, I think there's something really powerful in establishing your values and goals and like even having it like written down on a piece of paper or something for yourself to look at. Yeah. When I was a kid, when I was like in junior high, I remember thinking, I'm terrified all the time. Everyone's scared all the time, but I was like, you know, and I was like, I want to be a brave person. And I was like, that's who I want to be. And in my mind, I was like, that means when something scares me, I have to do it, which was like, you know, a little bit foolish and it's childish and it's masculine and it's like leads you to do stupid things. But this idea that you could establish the kind of there's like a Louis L'Amour quote I was obsessed with, which I thought was so good, which was like, up to a point in a man's life, they're shaped by their surroundings and circumstances and blah, blah, blah. But at some point, it's within everybody's power to say, this I am today, that I will be tomorrow. And from like a cowboy writer, I fucking like loved it. I was just like, damn, that's so good. And I got really into that idea. But it seems to be a universally helpful thing, whether it's dealing with how I react to partners or politics or the world or my own brain, to have some kind of touchstone externally, like written down, established for yourself, a practice of like, these are my values. This is who I want to be. This is who I believe I am in my ideal self. And like, when everything else is telling me otherwise, return to that. Try to be that person.
I mean, the faintest of ink outlasts the strongest memory. Right. So I think writing that stuff down is like, you got to do it.
I had a very stupid stoner thought one day about that like the invention of writing is like literal magic, that like the idea that you could make markings on a thing outside of you and that like you would forget a thing and then one day look at these markings and it would open parts of your brain that like you forgot you had and you'd be like, oh yes, that's like literal magic. Like that is that's a magic spell. You read a magic spell and it made you know things. Anyway, that we should rely on that, you know, bibliomancy.
I'm with you, man. Yeah, I think it's amazing. So hopefully that's helpful. If those discussions didn't answer people's questions, I hope they'll write us back and
we can take the notes out of it. I think that was great. That was great stuff today. I don't know. Thank you for all that. That's like, I don't know. I had takeaways. That was really helpful. But yes, as you write in if you got questions. You can hit me up at mygoodbadbrain@gmail.com. You can hit us on Instagram or Twitter or wherever. Patreon, blah, 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 blah. Let's do, just because it's fun, we're almost done. Do you have anything you want to put on the don't kill yourself list? Any good things in the world this week from you?
You know, I think I've done this before, but like I've been playing Call of Duty Warzone with like four friends.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so social. It's been really fun. Like it's fun. Yeah. We're like hanging out, you know?
Yeah. No,
that's I really enjoyed that.
I'm totally in accordance with that. Like the, I just like, we've been like, sometimes we just play like team fight tactics. It's this like legal, it's basically a card game on League of Legends. Like you're not really like very actively doing stuff, but you just hang out in a chat room and talk with each other. And it's like so nice. I really think the Zoom thing has been like kind of wonderful. I didn't tell you about this, but I was going to say like, I was going to talk about this when we're done, but this is probably my thing from the week, which isn't a really a good one, maybe because it's not super accessible, but it's like was such an exciting, cool thing. We've been doing these jiu-jitsu classes on Zoom where like my class still just meets up and twice a week and we do video breakdowns of stuff, which is amazing. This week on Thursday, Damian Maia dropped into our Zoom class.
What?
From Brazil. Real day fucking Damian Maia was like in our Zoom class. And of course, our coach Nathan is like, he's such a encyclopedic brain about, you know, we've been doing these in-depth breakdowns that he did. We were doing like video breakdowns of things that Marcelo Garcia does and then showing footage of Damian Maia and how he approaches the situation differently, and then having real Damian Maia there to be like, and also similarly, because they trained together a long time ago, and getting to hear like stories from Damian and him like reflecting on his own. He's like, wow, yeah, I never thought about it, but your breakdown is good. He was like, I was gonna stay for 20 minutes, but I stayed for an hour and a half. It was awesome. It was like,
that's
crazy.
So cool, man.
So
that's
crazy.
So cool.
Yeah. That's been like cool. What?
I said much respect.
Respect. Muito respect. I don't know. All right. Well, thank you guys so fucking much for being here. Yeah. And Rogue, I think, Rogue Avocado, who's also been doing my quarantine calisthenics, she's just said yes, COD, in the chat room. We should just get like a mental health Call of Duty stream going or something like that. That'd be so fun. We got like,
let me tell you, man, RPG in the end game. We just put it like that.
Dude, I'm going to like, going from like Tarkov and stuff to, I'm going to like lose my mind one way or the other, either because it's so good or because it's so annoying to like, of course, there's RPGs in that game, just noob tubing all day long. All right. That's enough. Thank you guys. Noon. I'm going to do quarantine calisthenics again live today. We're going to keep doing it. We've done 4 weeks straight. It's amazing. That's it. Happy Easter. Thank you, Nick. I'm going to hang up now. Easter.
Thank you guys. Yeah.
All right, see you guys next week. I'll put the stream up sooner this time. Oh, check out mygoodbadbrain.com if you want to get shirts or anything like that. Check out patreon.com/mygoodbadbrain if you feel like supporting the show with a couple bucks. And that's it. That's all I got right now.
Welcome to my good bad brain. I'm a normal person, so I'm insane. I've got depression and ADHD, but I'm doing better since I medicated me. Still not always.